Decades in the making, Terry Moe's Special Interests, Teacher Unions in America's Public Schools appears destined to be the definitive scholarly work on the subject. Today we talk with Moe about the book, the unions' rise to power, their influence on all facets of our education system, and whether changes within Democratic Party politics and the emergence of online learning create existential threats to these organizations. Join us for today's edition of the Education Next Book Club. Joining us today via Skype is Terry Moe, the author of Special Interests, Teacher Unions, and America's Public Schools. Terry, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So, Terry, this is quite a book, weighing in at about 500 pages, and in many ways it represents a lot of your life's work. People know you as being associated with this topic of studying teacher unions and collective bargaining. You've written extensively on the topic before. Why did you think it was important to get this book out?
Well, you know, it might seem odd, but there really isn't a comprehensive, scholarly, well-documented treatment of the teachers' unions out there. You know, they're by far the most powerful force in American education. You'd think that researchers would have been studying them for the past 20, 30 years. But in fact, just the opposite is the case. They've almost never been studied. You know, there's a very small literature. And what I've tried to do is both to study them myself and to sort of pull together everything that's known into a coherent treatment that begins with their rise to power, talks about their nature as organizations, and then talks about how they exercise their power in local politics, in collective bargaining, and in state and national policymaking, and try to cover all the bases.
And you write about how you come at this as a scholar of institutionalism. Why is that important for people to understand?
Well, a couple of reasons. One is that I'm not just some sort of right-wing nut that decided to write a book on unions. You know, I've been a political scientist for 30 years or more, hard to believe. I have written widely on American politics and published in professional journals on the presidency and public bureaucracy and the theory of organizations and institutions. You know, I don't just write on education. And when I approach this topic, I approach it in exactly the same way that I approach any other institutional topic in American politics or politics generally. And it's important for people to know that there's an analytic perspective behind this that is bigger than me. You know, there's a whole field of institutionalism that shares this same basic set of analytics. And I think it has a lot to say about how we can go about understanding the teachers' unions and their role in education.
So you write, for example, that institutionalists will say, look, politicians, congressmen are not bad people because they do things like go after earmarks. That's just what their job is in that institution as it's set up.
Well, I think, you know, the way we would understand members of Congress is not... this sounds odd to say, but not as human beings. You know, it wouldn't say, well, you know, what's their family life like, you know, and what do they personally believe about all these? Really, what we want to know first and foremost is how are their incentives structured as members of Congress? And what it comes down to is they are elected from districts. If they want to get reelected from those districts, they have to bring home the bacon to their districts. They have to be responsive to powerful groups. And so the result is that members of Congress behave in very predictable, regular ways. And they often do things that we don't like, you know, but they're very understandable, you know. And so when they load up a piece of legislation with 5,000 earmarks, you know, we can all scream about it, but there's a reason that they're doing that. It's because their incentives are structured in a certain way. Okay, well, this is the way institutionalists just think about politics. You know, we start with the institutions that structure incentives the incentives tell us a lot about how the different players are going to play the game, how they're going to behave. And exactly the same thing applies to education.
Right. And so you say, for example, look, you don't have to believe that Randy Weingarten is a bad human being in order to defend bad teachers or to defend the rubber rooms. You just have to understand the institutions of America's schools, politics, unions.
Yes. I think that this is such an important point, you know, because politics gets very personal. You know, when people try to assess what's going on in education, they look at what Randy Weingarten does, and they might get mad at her as a person or think she's a bad person because she's protecting incompetent teachers. Or on the other side, when she talks about what a reformer she is and how she really favors performance-based evaluations and all these things, and how she really wants to do what's best for kids, many people tend to believe that, you know, when really the way to understand her behavior is she is a union president. And all union presidents have incentives that are structured in a very particular way, right? Members join unions because they want their jobs protected. You know, they want better benefits. They want better wages. They want restrictive work rules that protect them in the workplace. And that's what union leaders do. And whatever they might say in politics, they're going to have to do these basic things. Also, whatever they might believe as human beings, like Randy Weingarten might love children and she might desperately want the schools to be better. But that doesn't govern what she does as a union president. She will still protect incompetent teachers and try to take action to see to it that nobody ever loses a job.
Okay. All right. Well, you start the book by looking at history. You say, where did these teacher unions come from? And even more fundamentally, where did these public employee unions come from? As you describe, for a long part of our history, even liberals like Franklin Delano Roosevelt would argue that there was no role for government unions. Why did that change?
It basically changed because of, number one, power. The private sector unions, which were given an enormous boost by the National Labor Relations Act of 1935, became very powerful in the 1950s, especially. That's when they hit their zenith. Nobody knew it was their zenith at the time, you know, but that's when they were at their most powerful. And they became strongly allied with the Democratic Party right about then. And so it was a natural for them to think, you know, wow, if we could unionize the public sector unions, this would just add to our power. And so lo and behold, in 1959, Wisconsin passed the first public sector labor law, which promoted union organization and collective bargaining, made it much easier. And during the 1960s and 70s, many states followed suit. And so what really happened was that because of the private sector unions and the Democrats pushing for these things, these reforms, the laws changed. And once the laws changed, public sector workers started getting unionized and with collective bargaining in state after state all around the country outside the South. And that was the key thing. It wasn't that, you know, teachers were somehow being victimized and they rose up and they joined unions and so on. Teachers got organized and got collective bargaining at exactly the same time that police officers and firefighters and nurses and sanitation workers and other public sector workers got it. And that was in the 60s and 70s.
Though it's fair to say the conditions for teachers weren't all that great.
It depends on who you talk to and who you compare them to. I have no doubt that bad things happen to some teachers. You know, I mean, women who were pregnant would get fired. And there are all kinds of horror stories, things that, you know, we wouldn't want to have happen. But these kinds of things were happening all over the country in all kinds of industries. And so all I'm trying to do in the book is to explain why teachers got organized.
Okay.
Right. And so it wasn't because teachers were particularly victimized. It was because the laws changed.
Right.
And teachers got unionized at exactly the same time as all the other public sector workers got unionized.
Right. Now, you spend a fair amount of time looking at the issue of forced membership of teacher unions. So, mm-hmm. you know, teachers being required to join these unions. Why is that so important?
Well, I think in part it's important because there are a lot of people who believe, especially conservatives, who believe that teachers are forced to join unions by the laws. And as a result, there are a lot of teachers inside unions who don't want to be there and who are dissatisfied. And as a result, the unions are sort of seen as involuntary organizations with a captive clientele. And union leaders are sort of bosses who are running the show, but they're not really representing their members. And I think all of that is basically wrong. Teachers actually can't be forced to join unions. That's unconstitutional. They can be forced to pay. Right? They can be forced to pay agency fees in many states. But the fact is, as I show in one of the chapters of my book, if you just ask teachers, would you voluntarily join your local union if you had a totally free choice? Well over 90% say yes. And this is true even for Republicans. Now, teachers in general love their local unions and they really support collective bargaining. And this is the bedrock of teacher union power, and it is voluntary.
And they love that collective bargaining. Why? Because they think it's resulted in better pay and better benefits for them?
Yes. They think it's good for them.
And yet we've seen so many teachers being willing to move to charter schools where, of course, there's no collective bargaining.
Well, actually, there have been some teachers who have, but only 3.5% of the kids in this country are in charter schools. So it's important not to exaggerate the importance of that from the teacher's standpoint.
Yeah. All right, let's talk about school boards. You spend a chapter on these institutions, and basically you argue, as others have, the unions get school board members elected, and then they sit down together to collectively bargain.
And good deal.
unions on both sides of the table.
Yeah.
How does this work? What's going on here?
It's one of the I suppose there are many perversions of democracy in this country, and in some cases maybe they're unavoidable. But here, we have a situation where the teachers' unions are going to be bargaining with the district. The district is represented by the school board. The school board consists of people who have the authority to run the district. Well, they're elected. And so the unions can participate in those elections. And in most districts, they are the most powerful organized force in the elections. Well, what's their incentive? Their incentive is to get people elected who are sympathetic to collective bargaining and who are their allies. And that's what they do. Right now, they can't do it perfectly, but it's totally different than what happens in the private sector. Right? In the private sector, the unions have to sit down and bargain with an independent management team that represents the firm. And that is not happening in the public sector. They're sitting down with people who are often their allies, who are beholden to them, who are afraid of them, and who are willing to give them many of the things that they demand, especially when it comes to inexpensive things like work rules, and who are not 100% just representing ordinary citizens.
So you look at the impact of district size and culture on the way this plays out. What do you find about that?
Well, the interesting thing about size is I think we have this stereotype that the unions are really, really powerful in the big districts, and they're not very powerful in the small districts. But I think the evidence suggests that actually they're powerful everywhere. That doesn't mean that they're powerful in 100% of the districts, but they're also powerful in small districts, right? And really, in small districts, they don't have a lot of competition. In big districts, the unions are big, and they have a lot of members and a lot of money. But on the other hand, there are a lot of groups in urban areas, civic groups, religious groups, various kinds of reform groups, business groups that sometimes will compete with the unions and make their lives more difficult and oppose them. Whereas in much smaller settings, those settings are less pluralistic and the unions don't have as much competition. So I think it sort of evens out that way. So I don't think we want to assume that, that unions are just sort of a problem and wield special power in large districts. They're doing it in districts of all size. And on the culture issue that you mentioned, I think we might have a tendency to think, wow, in some districts, in Republican districts, the unions are at a real disadvantage because, you know, you're going to have these very conservative school boards. Well, not really. I mean, the unions adapt to that. They're able to find Republicans who are sympathetic to collective bargaining, and they get them elected, right? So the unions actually do quite well in Republican districts. They don't, on average, do as well. And so the conservatism of those districts does slightly work against them. I mean, democracy doesn't count for nothing, but the unions adapt to it very well, and they still get Republicans who are sympathetic to collective bargaining.
Okay, we're talking today with Terry Moe, the author of Special Interests, Teacher Unions in America's Public Schools. We'll be right back after this short break.
For in-depth features, cutting-edge research, and up-to-the-minute commentary on education policy, check out educationnext.org. There you'll find blog entries, new articles published weekly, plus videos, podcasts, and more. That's educationnext.org.
Speaking today with Terry Moe, author of Special Interests, Teacher Unions, and America's Public Schools, who's joining us via Skype. Terry, let's talk about a chapter you have in here called Small Victories for Sanity. Now, you describe the major changes that are taking place in New Orleans, New York, and Washington, D.C. What's happening in those places?
Well, you know, in New York and Washington, D.C., what happened was that you had strong mayors who were committed to education reform, who brought in strong school chancellors, Joel Klein and Michelle Rhee, to bring about major change. And the way to do that, it turns out, is to take on the labor contract and take on the local teachers union. There is just no alternative if you want to change education. And so that led to years of conflict. And in the end, I think Joel Klein was able to achieve some victories, small victories for sanity. You know, in New York City, he got some rules changed about seniority transfers. He got, you know, performance-based bonuses for whole schools and a few other things. You know, but for the most part, it was an enormously frustrating experience where most of the things he wanted, he didn't get. He wasn't able to change things much. And even in order to get the small rules changes that he got, he had, or Bloomberg had to pay the unions enormous amounts of money. So it was, in a way, it was like a big bribe, you know, like the contract had been larded up with all these restrictive work rules over a period of 20, 30 years. And then Joel Klein comes in, and in order to try to get rid of some of these rules, the unions say, well, we're not giving them up unless you pay us a fortune. And that's essentially what happened.
And not just in salaries, of course. Recently, there was news that a five-year merit pay pilot has been suspended. It was found not to be very effective. But the way that the mayor got that merit pay program through was by making a huge concession, expensive concession around pensions.
Yes. Yeah. So, you know, here you have sort of what looks like a perfect reform situation. You have a mayor who's really powerful and committed. You have this terrific school chancellor who's powerful and committed. And what have they been able to achieve? Not much. You know, I give them tremendous credit for trying.
Now, the story was somewhat different in Washington, D.C., right? Michelle Rhee got a groundbreaking contract through.
Absolutely. So that was sort of the next point. Michelle Rhee really did achieve a lot. I think one of the reasons, you'd have to say, is that in that district now, almost 40% of the kids are in charter schools. And, you know, the teachers union has been drained of members. It is much weaker than the United Federation of Teachers in New York City. It's a union on the run, man. They are in serious trouble, and they know that if they continue to stonewall, the regular public schools are just going to lose more and more kids. So I think that their leader, George Parker, was more receptive to some kind of change than Randy Weingarten was in New York City. And Michelle Rhee was just, you know, relentless in pushing for change. She had the total support of Adrian Fenty. And, you know, she was able to achieve what I consider to be a great victory. But the Achilles heel in any city like this is that the mayor is elected and the mayor can be defeated. And Adrian Fenty was defeated and Michelle Rhee is out. And so now the union's candidate, Vincent Gray, is the mayor. And so far, you know, I mean, the worry is, okay, now the fox is in the chicken coop. And what in God's name is going to happen to this contract now going forward? So far, things look pretty good. I mean, surprisingly, Mayor Gray seems to be, you know, holding to the spirit of the contract. And Kaya Henderson was an aide to Michelle Rhee and is a reformer, as far as I know. So far, things look good there. But, you know, they could change so easily because Gray is the union's candidate.
Though recently, as we're doing this interview just a few weeks ago, about 200 teachers were fired based on their performance.
Yes.
This is something that almost has never happened before in American education.
I know. It's stunning. It's great. So, but you have to ask yourself, okay, what does this mean? You know, do you think Randy Weingarten wants this to become a template for reform all around the country? Absolutely not. How many districts are there? You know, 14,000. Washington, D.C. is one of them. So I think if people think this is somehow going to proliferate throughout the country, they're going to be disappointed.
So that's why you consider these to be just small victories.
Well, I think Michelle Rhee's victory was a big one. And the question is whether it can stand up over time, mm-hmm. right? Because she's gone and Adrian Fenty is gone. In New York City, they were, you know, I mean, the transfer rights victory was a big one, but basically that whole Byzantine, bizarre organizational structure in New York City is still there. The union is still incredibly powerful. And so I would say that the progress there has been minimal.
Mm-hmm. And then there's New Orleans, of course, where the union was basically decimated after the hurricane. And as far as I know, has still not been reconstituted in any significant way. Do you see that kind of thing playing out in other cities? Some people say maybe Detroit could be the next one facing such huge challenges that it could have New Orleans-style reforms.
Yeah. You know, I think the fascinating thing about New Orleans is that it's a totally unique situation. What you had was an act of God, Katrina, that literally destroyed the school system. It wiped out the union and the power structure in New Orleans. And for the first time in modern American history, we had a school system that was unprotected by power, where reformers, and they had reformers in place. The governor was interested in reform. The head of the school board, Pastorick, or the state school board, was interested in reform. They hired Paul Vallis at the local level, wanted reform, and they were able to move ahead with reform without being blocked. Nowhere in this country has that ever happened before. And so what we're able to see in New Orleans is what happens when you can basically take the union out. And so the question is there anything there? Is there any there? Is there a real reformist energy that will rush in and do something big when the unions aren't blocking them? And the answer in New Orleans is absolutely yes. New Orleans now has a school system in which over 70% of the kids are in charter schools. Every kid chooses a school. The New Orleans school system doesn't look like any other school system in the entire country.
Mm-hmm. But you see, as with the D.C. contract, there's a good chance that will be contained just to New Orleans, that the unions will keep that sort of reform from spreading.
Yeah, and the reason is, okay, the power structure in New Orleans was destroyed.
Yeah.
But the union still has a presence throughout Louisiana and at the state level and at the national level. Well, the AFT doesn't want this to happen in New Orleans. The state AFT doesn't want this, the state affiliate of the AFT doesn't want this to happen. And they're going to be working tirelessly in the years ahead to undermine what's happened in New Orleans and to take it back to a regular school system.
You know, you keep using the word block or blocking, the union's blocking this, blocking that. You have a whole section in here on the politics of blocking. Explain what you mean by that.
Well, you know, we're blessed in this country with a system of separation of powers and checks and balances, and we all grow up thinking this is just the greatest, you know, and in some ways it is. I mean, we have this kind of a system to prevent tyranny of the majority and to allow minorities of various kind to block, to protect their rights and so on. On a day-to-day basis, what it really means is that it's really difficult to get legislation passed and it's really easy to block. Because, you know, take Congress, for instance, you know, in order to get a bill passed, you have to get it through a few committees in the House, and then it has to pass on the floor of the House. It has to get through a few committees in the Senate, and then it has to pass on the floor of the Senate. Then you have to have identical bills, you know, arrived at in a conference committee. It has to go back to the floor of the House, back to the floor of the Senate, and then the president has to sign the thing. Okay, if you want to pass a bill, you have to get through every single one of those stages. But if you want to block a bill, you just have to win once at any one of those steps, and you win, you block. Okay, so if you're a powerful group, that's a fairly easy thing to do. It's much easier than getting something done. So I would say over the past quarter century, the unions have basically been in the business of blocking. It's not that they're out there getting everything they want. It's that they're blocking and weakening major reforms that they don't want. And so they've been stifling in various ways: school choice, accountability, performance-based pay, performance-based evaluations, the whole deal, right? And even when it looks like we're making progress, they're in there weakening these things so that they don't really amount to that much.
Okay, we're talking with Terry Moe, author of Special Interests, Teacher Unions in America's Public Schools. We're going to take one more break, and then we'll be right back.
For in-depth features, cutting-edge research, and up-to-the-minute commentary on education policy, check out educationnext.org. There you'll find blog entries, new articles published weekly, plus videos, podcasts, and more. That's educationnext.org.
Talking to Terry Moe, author of Special Interest. Terry's joining us via Skype from his office at Stanford University. Is that right, Terry?
That's right.
Okay. I can, you know, I'm talking to Terry via Skype, and I can see what looks to be perhaps a Stanford chair in the background there. Well, Terry, we've talked a lot about the union's past and present. Let's talk a little bit about the future. You say that we are at a critical juncture and that there's some big changes underway. One is around the Democratic Party politics and the teacher unions. What's happening?
Well, let me just say one other thing first, and that is that I think a lot of people might be thinking, wow, look what happened in Wisconsin, or look what happened in Ohio, or Idaho, or Tennessee, right? Where, you know, since the 2010 elections, there have been some states that have adopted some pretty serious reforms, weakening tenure and requiring performance-based evaluations and so on, and also weakening collective bargaining rights. And I think some people would think, okay, you know, I mean, that means that the unions are going down. You know, the unions are on the run. The unions are weak now. But what I would say is, look, this is a temporary thing. This is a perfect storm that happened because a number of things came together. The Republicans gained firm control with oversized majorities in a few states, big states, Michigan, Wisconsin, Ohio, and so on, the states where, with Tea Party backing and so on, the Republicans, and also fueled by the financial crisis and the underfunded pension problem, the Republicans moved ahead and enacted historically unprecedented reforms that the unions were unable to block, right, because of these oversized Republican majorities. But, you know, moving forward, what's going to happen is that the Democrats will eventually regain control of most of these states. They'll do something about these reforms. The financial crisis is going to pass. The unions, meantime, are launching recall campaigns. They're putting initiatives on ballots to have these things overturned. They're launching court cases to have these things overturned, and they're gearing up for 2012. So I think, you know, okay, so this was a perfect storm, but the unions are just as powerful as they ever were. And the reformers are gonna wake up in 2012 or 2013, and things are gonna look bad, right? So, okay, so this is not the watershed that the Republicans did these things. But there are a couple of other things that I think are going to sap the union's power long term. And it's important to think big picture about this and not be obsessed with just current events. Mm-hmm. Okay, so Democratic Party. I think that the unions, teachers' unions, are losing their grip on the Democratic Party. You know, they've had a grip on it since the unions emerged. Look, the teachers' unions have 4.5 million members. You know, they have a ton of money that they contribute to politics. They're among the very top contributors to political campaigns. They have political activists in almost every district in the country. And they spend almost all their money on Democrats. And the Democrats are very dependent on them, right? The unions are core members of the Democratic coalition. And so for decades, the Democrats have basically carried the water for the unions. And the unions have opposed reform, and the Democrats have been the ones casting the official votes, you know, to block these things. Okay, so I think that now, especially with the accountability movement and with all this evidence coming out about how bad many urban schools are and how disadvantaged kids are doing, are being shortchanged so badly, groups representing the disadvantaged are standing up and separating themselves from the unions and saying, look, you guys are obstructing reform and we've had it. You know, we're not going to be in alliance with you anymore in blocking these reforms. The Democrats for Education Reform, you know, is a major new group that brings together very high profile people like Cory Booker, Roy Romer, you know, and many others who are willing to just stand up and say, look, Democrats have been wrong on education for the past couple of decades. We have to stop this. We have to stand up for disadvantaged kids. We have to separate ourselves from the unions. Read Time Magazine, Newsweek, Washington Post. These are basically liberal writers who are coming out all the time now and excoriating the unions for blocking reform. And then there's Race to the Top. You know, where a Democratic president and the Secretary of Education launched this program that pushed reforms, you know, performance-based evaluations, charter schools, and so on, that the unions are totally opposed to. Why did they do that? Why didn't they just do what the unions wanted? They didn't. It's huge. So I think long-term, this is terrible for the for the unions. And I think over time, it's just going to get worse. So that's a big thing, right? And the fact that the Republicans have won a couple of victories is not a big thing. But when the unions start losing their base, when they start losing their support among Democrats, they are in very serious trouble. And this is going to go on increasingly over time. So there's that, but then there's also another reason that you may want to talk about, which is technology.
Right. So you also say that this force from sort of outside the system, this technological force, is going to weaken the unions. You talk about this at length in your book with John Chubb, Liberated Learning. You refer to it a little bit in this book. I guess the big question here is to say what, you know, I think we can all understand why education technology could weaken unions if you start to replace, you know, labor with capital, if you have kids learning from teachers that maybe aren't certified or aren't parts of the unions. But aren't the unions just going to be effective at blocking these reforms too? I mean, so far, in most places, they've kept online learning to be pretty minimal, maybe small programs at the district level, not very widespread. Why do we think that's going to change?
Well, this is something that we deal with at length in Liberating Learning. and that I also talk about at the end of my book here, Special Interest. And I think, number one, the unions are not dumb, and they know that technology is very, very threatening to them. Because if you have a whole bunch of kids taking their classes through online learning, there's going to be a massive substitution of technology for labor. And education will no longer be as labor intensive as it is now. We won't need as many teachers per student. There won't be as many union members per student. Plus, teachers will be all over the place. You know, they won't be concentrated in districts. Online teachers can be anywhere, and they'll be much more difficult to organize. And there will also be a lot more providers, virtual providers. And money and jobs will be flowing out of the regular public schools, which are unionized, into these non-union providers. And you know, the combination of these things is going to be devastating. So the question is, why would the unions ever allow this to happen? You know, so their line now is, oh, we're all in favor of technology, but we just think the district should control it, right? So we want to have more computers in the classroom, and we'll do web-based research and all this stuff. But of course, we need just as many teachers as ever before, you know, keep everything just the same, just as labor intensive. So that's their line. And what they've done is to use their power with the states to try to disallow virtual charter schools and to try to make sure that this thing doesn't get anywhere. It doesn't get out of control. But I think big picture, You have to see this for what it is. We're in the middle of an information revolution on this planet, right? The revolution in information technology is changing the fundamentals of human society everywhere in the world, right? The way people interact with one another, the way they use information, the way they get knowledge and so on. And it can't help but transform the way kids learn. And plus, kids love this. Plus, it's cheaper by a lot than having a human being there with benefits teaching the child. And so I think what we're going to get, whether the unions want it or not, you know, is a system that maybe 10 years from now or 20 years from now, because the unions are trying to stop it, so it'll go slowly, it's going to seep in anyway. We'll have a system where kids go to school because their parents want them to go to school. They don't want them sitting at home on a computer, right? So they'll go to school. But when they're at school, they'll take maybe 80% of their coursework online. Mm-hmm. And there just won't be as many teachers as before. And the whole education system will look very different. And the unions will be much weaker. It's a very profound structural thing. It's a tsunami that's just going to sweep the planet. It won't just happen in this country. It's going to happen all over the place.
But Terry,
and the unions can't stop it.
Now people might say that, hey, Terry, you know, you said very similar things about school choice 20 years ago, and that did not pan out to be the, I think the word at the time was panacea. It was not this tidal wave that you described it to be. So, I mean, is
I didn't say that. What I did say, the panacea thing, although... in that article, what we said was, the title of the article was Choice is a Panacea, but inside the article, what we said is, look, we're not stupid. I mean, we're not literally saying it's a panacea. What we're saying is that when you have a choice system, what you're doing is you're changing everybody's incentives. And that's what you want to do. If you want to have an effective system, what you want to do is to give everybody incentives to do their best, right? To have productive organizations, to learn as much as possible. And choice can do that, right? By giving people alternatives, but also by creating competition among the providers and so on. Okay, so that's what on the beneficial side of choice, why choice is important for the country and can provide people with options and a more effective education. But we never said choice is going to sweep the country. Because what we believe then is the same thing I believe now, which is that there is enormous opposition and the opposition has the advantage, right? So we thought progress would be extremely difficult and slow.
Yeah. So one last question, Terry. Is it fair to say that you think that unions will be much weaker, say, 20 years from now than they are today?
Yes, absolutely.
But will they go away entirely?
Probably not. No. But I think that they will simply have fewer members, a lot less money, a lot less political clout, and their influence on the way schools are organized and the way schools perform will be much weaker. And all that's a very good thing.
Okay. We've been talking with Terry Moe, the author of Special Interest, Teacher Unions in America's Public Schools, published by the Brookings Institution, available at your favorite bookstore and online, I'm sure, at Amazon.com and other places.
Yes,
Terry,
indeed.
Thanks so much for joining us. You've been listening to the Education Next Book Club. Executive producer of the Education Next Book Club is Marcy Kanstrom. Audio engineer is Joe Portnoy, and I'm your host, Mike Petrilli, for the Education Next Book Club.